Good morning slash good afternoon, everyone. My name is Daniel Sahinsky. I'm the Deputy Director of the China and the World Program. Today, I have the distinguished honor of welcoming Enza Han to today's talk. Enza is an associate professor in the Department of Politics and Public Administration at the University of Hong Kong. His recent publications and the title of today's talk, The Ripple Effect, China's Complex Presence in Southeast Asia, Oxford University Press from 2024. He's also recently published Asymmetric Neighbors, Borderland State Building Between China and Southeast Asia, also from Oxford University Press in 2019. Contestation and Adaptation, The Politics of National Identity in China, also from Oxford University Press from 2013, and various articles appearing in the journals of politics, international affairs, world development, China Quarterly, Security Studies, Conflict Management, and Peace Studies, as well as the Journal of Ethnic and Migration Studies, among many others. During 2015 to 2016, he was a Friends Founding Circles member of the School of Social Sciences at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton in the United States. His research has been supported by the Liverhulme Research Fellowship and the British Council / Newton Fund. He has been awarded the Distinguished Fellow on Contemporary Southeast Asia by the Lee Kuan Chian National University of Singapore / Stanford Institute on Southeast Asia in 2021. His PhD is from the George Washington University in DC, and he was also most notably a postdoc in the China and the World program when we were based at Princeton. Warm welcome to Enza Han.
All right, thank you, Daniel. So today I'm very happy to, so I'll just get right in. How do we understand China's global influence? And this is, I think, it's a phenomenon, a topic that has interested many people, and particularly the phenomenon of global China. And these days, people are interested in the many forms of presence that global China has taken in terms of both in terms of state presence around the world, but also many other actors coming up on China in terms of foreign investment, labor export, and many other institutional building and et cetera, in terms of how multifaceted kind of aspect of global China. So then one of the main questions that have been motivating many people to their empirical study is that how do we measure, how do we understand the implications of such a presence of China? Now, in existing literature of international relations, and people conventionally speaking tend to differentiate the two concepts of power versus influence. And particularly in Evelyn Goh's definition of influence, essentially is a step further than the power definition, in the sense that it is the actual effective exercise of power, right? The ability to make use of power and translate that into action. However, in such existing accounts of definition, people still tend to focus quite exclusively on the state, right? And that's usually most of the literature on influence tend to be very state-centric. So that means many non-state actors are not necessarily part of this kind of empirical examination. At the same time, the concept of influence itself involve quite a lot of emphasis on intentionality, in a sense, right? That basically there is particular intended, the intention of a particular actor to achieve a particular goal. But then again, in reality, and then when we start empirical analysis, then oftentimes it is more interesting to look at what are the intended outcomes versus many other unintended consequences of purpose of social action. So this is basically some of the starting point of my talk. Essentially, is try to look at not only the state but also non-state actors, and also empirically examine the differences between intended versus unintended consequences of China's presence in Southeast Asia. Now, why Southeast Asia and why China and Southeast Asia? I think in some ways, when we think about global China, obviously China has taken on a global reach for its presence, but in many other ways, Southeast Asia is quite distinct, in a sense that this is the region perhaps has the most amount of intimate encounters with China, historically as well as contemporarily. Part of the reason is because of geographical proximity, in the sense that this is the place that has a long history of engagement with polities based in China, but also because of the history, centuries of migration coming out from China to Southeast Asia that make the relationship between Southeast Asia and China tend to be much more intimate than in comparison to other parts of the world. And similarly, and these days people are interested in, there's lots of tension focusing on Southeast Asia as a center for geopolitical competition between China and the United States. And that's why I think today that's basically there is more, there's need to understand why, how can we understand China's relation with Southeast Asia and then its multifaceted presence in the region. So the argument of the book, and in some ways how to confess, is that it is not really a thesis, rather than it's an antithesis, in a sense that it's more of a sort of response to many existing works on China's presence in Southeast Asia, in a sense that I'm arguing against a very singular focus on the Chinese state, in a sense that we do also need to take account into many non-state actors coming up on China. And the second point is that on intentionality, in a sense that we need to empirically examine what exactly is the intended outcome versus many other unintended consequences of China's presence. So in a sense that the book is really trying to do these two things. First is to differentiate between state and the non-state actors, and then to also differentiate between intended and also unintended consequences of China's influence in the region. So with that, and I will give you three snippets of the book in a way that the first part is about economic relations, economic influences, and then I will talk about political as well as some kind of another case of mundane influence on Chinese consumption. Now, the first one is on economic relations, and I think overall has, you know, this is probably one of the most prominent aspects of China's growing economic presence, and also as the largest trading partner for Southeast Asia. And then obviously on the one hand, people have been looking at, you know, the causes for this rising bilateral trade relations between China and Southeast Asia. And in particular, around 2019 and 20, right? That's a time basically Southeast Asia as a whole became China's largest trading partner. And that was quite a milestone event, in a sense that ASEAN as overall took over from the EU, and the US became the largest trading partner of China. But then again, when we look at the reason why this sort of rising trade volume occurred, in some ways, this was because of the unintended consequences of China's, you know, trade war with the United States, right? And then part of the reason, there are two factors actually led to this, increasing trade volume between China and Southeast Asia, is that first is to bypass the American, tariffs on China in a way that quite a lot of trade were diverted through Southeast Asia in a process called transshipment, in a way that many products were predominantly, you know, produced in China, but assembled in Vietnam or Malaysia, and then, transshipped to the US and as well to other parts of the world. Additionally, there was another element, was the implications for the sanctions on Xinjiang, in a way that quite a lot of agricultural products from China, from Xinjiang, particularly cotton, were also transshipped through Southeast Asia and mixed with other cottons from the world and being made into textiles and then shipped out as well to other parts of the world. So which is a process, some people have called it, it's called cotton washing. But then essentially it was an outcome that occurred as a result of the political sanctions and then other trade war between China and South, and then, you know, the United States. And then at the same time, also, if we look at the dimension of investment, on the one hand, we can definitely see a very clear intended sort of intention by the Chinese state try to implement a integrated infrastructure system within Southeast Asia, right? So one of the most noticeable projects is the high-speed rail between linking China with mainland Southeast Asian countries. For example, particularly right now, there's the three sections, one in Laos, connecting Yunnan with Laos, and also there's the sections in Thailand and Malaysia are still under construction. So what has happened so far is the ability of the Chinese state in this particular instance to set a standard for how a modern high-speed rail system is going to be implemented in Southeast Asia. And so on the one hand is the standard setting in a way that the railway and its service provision and etc., its payment system, etc., are all basically Chinese standard. And at the same time, it also has the ability to integrate a transnational infrastructure, a transportation system that previously never existed, right? So this is basically has the potential to link further basically China with other Southeast Asian countries through through an integrated transportation system. So this is very much a case of a clear intention and by the Chinese state to have this presence felt within Southeast Asia. But on the other hand, if we look outside the state capital, in this particular case, the infrastructure investment, many other private capital are also going to Southeast Asia. And this is a process that has been described as Chuhai in a way that many Chinese companies, either big or small, are going to Southeast Asia for business opportunities, right? So this is essentially a process. On the one hand, it's a response to the geopolitical situation, right? It is often the case that quite a lot of big Chinese private companies tend to bifurcate their business operation and to set up a headquarter in Singapore for their international operation, right? So this is very much a commercial response to the political condition, and in a way that to separate that China-focused operation from their international operation, where that is going to be centered in the headquarters in Singapore. At the same time, we have also seen that many Chinese companies are looking at Southeast Asia as a potential market, right? And this is basically the region where almost have a half the population of China. And then this is basically the future of consumerism, in a sense that many Chinese companies are looking to Southeast Asia for business opportunities. So this is in this particular area, we have seen a big booming of Chinese companies in the sectors of e-commerce and also in logistics, in a way that they are expanding in Southeast Asia with the model that they have been previously successful in China to open a market in Southeast Asia for commerce. So in this particular case, when we see a widespread of Chinese business presence in Southeast Asia, but then most of them are in fact spearheaded by private capital rather than the Chinese state in this particular case. Now let's move on to the political dimension, right? And one of the interesting aspects obviously people are interested in is how much influence authoritarianism in China has on Southeast Asia, right? And then, Jessica Chen Weiss, for example, previously has mentioned that the role China played in making authoritarianism work, right? In a way that providing an alternative model, providing finance, providing technologies, etc. So what is the empirical result of or empirical variation in Southeast Asia? Now, on the one hand, we do see that Southeast Asia tend to be quite authoritarian overall. And in particular, quite a lot of countries on mainland Southeast Asia tend to be more authoritarian than the maritime countries, right? And in some ways, pretty much, you can say almost all the countries on the mainland, in mainland Southeast Asia are authoritarian. Then the question is, so, you know, on the one hand, if you're really looking at this kind of geographical proximity, then you will say, you might conclude, well, because these countries are closer to China, then they were all authoritarian, right? So how much empirical support is there for such an argument? And I think the empirical results is quite mixed, right? The first one, obviously, is a confirming case where China provides explicit support for the military government in Myanmar. So this has been, you know, I think empirically quite solid case where the Chinese government's ability to shelter the military government from international sanction and also has the ability to recognize the military government in a way that boosted and the legitimacy of the military since 2021 coup. So this is very much, for example, in some case, easy case, and I will not be willing, I don't need to dwell on it so much, right? Basically, very support, very easy case of support for the authoritarian government. Now, the second case I'll look at is basically Cambodia, right? Now, in the Cambodian case, the country is not as dependent upon China's diplomatic protection. In fact, there is not really any country is isolating Cambodia in that sense. So the impact of China's presence in Cambodia can be looked at through its intimate economic relations with the country, in the sense that China is largest investor and aid donor for Cambodia in a way that a quarter of its FDI goes to Cambodia. Cambodia's quarter of Cambodia's FDI came from China, and as well as half of Cambodia's ODA came from China, which financed 70% of its infrastructure, etc. And in some ways, we can argue that much of the Cambodian government's ability to provide some, you know, necessary public goods are in fact being bankrolled by Chinese money. So one good example of that is COVID vaccines. So at that time, Cambodia, despite its being a, you know, relatively poor country, it was the second fastest country in Southeast Asia to reach a very high level of vaccination rate in a very short period of time, right? So other than Singapore, right? So Singapore basically was the first one to do that, but then Cambodia actually was very quick to implement the vaccination procedures that reached 90% of its population. So in reality, the case was that China basically donated those vaccines to the Hun Sen government, and in some ways, basically indirectly boosted the performance legitimacy of the Hun Sen government. And this is basically what I argue is a case of indirect, unintended kind of consequences of basically by engaging China economically that can benefit the incumbent government in Southeast Asia. Lastly is the case of Thailand. Now, Thailand is a very interesting case in the sense that it is neither diplomatically isolated, right? And in fact, it's a US ally. It also does not require that much on Chinese money, right? The biggest investor in Thailand, in fact, is Japan. But then on the other hand, Thailand also has a history of military government and a continuation of the authoritarian presence in a country despite periodic elections, but then still the nature of the regime remains to be authoritarian. So what has happened in Thailand's case empirically is that we see on the one hand, there's very clear polarization in a country where you have the conservative, you know, pro-military element, and then you have the other side where you have the pro-democracy camp that has been campaigning against each other for quite a long time. So what empirically happens was that the pro-military conservative element within a country have deliberately played up the China's presence in the country to legitimize themselves. So this is what I call a strategic use of the China card by the other country, in this particular case, Thailand, to strengthen the power of the conservative element at the expense of the opposition. So what is typically the case is the conservative element try to domestically propagate more merits of the Chinese model on development and then stability, and also in many other cases, many other instances also is basically accusing opposition as on the payroll of the United States. So basically that is kind of the dimension. Basically, in some ways you can argue that the great power competition has been being internalized within the domestic politics. And so that's why in this case of Thailand, we did not have any strategic, very strong evidence of how Beijing is specifically trying to influence the conservative element within the country. Rather, it is opposite in a way that the conservative element in the country making use of China to strengthen their position within the country. Right, so that's how I would empirically argue that is that the causal mechanism is in fact quite messy, right, in terms of how much authoritarianism in Thailand was attributed, can be attributed to China's role. Finally, I'll talk about a case of mundane implication of Chinese consumption and also its implications on environmental degradation in Southeast Asia, in the case of Northern Myanmar. Empirically, we have actually these days have observed accelerated pace of deforestation in Myanmar from many satellite data and the global forest change data set, for example, has noticed that between 2000 and 2019, quite substantial percentages of the country forest has been lost. Now, previously, many people would look at the deforestation in Myanmar tend to focus on timber trade. But timber trade pretty much continue to be an important factor. But then again, after 2012, when the government banned export of raw timber, then the implications of timber trade on environmental degradation has reduced. On the other hand, another factor basically become much more prominent. It is basically agricultural transformation. There is a commercialization of agriculture within the country. So this coincided with several factors. First one is global. Around 2012-13, there was a global commodity price shock. Basically, the price of corn went up significantly. So this phenomenon was also the same can be applicable to wheat and also corn in a way that around 2010 to 11, there was global hike of the price of maize. So what happened is that likewise within Myanmar, and that has been an increase of production of maize plantation within the country. And so then add on to another level of complexity is that with the rising price of corn, and then, well, if you do respond into this global market incentive, where would you sell this corn to, right? And then in this case, for Myanmar, you have an easy market that is right next door in China. Domestically in China, there was a rising consumption of meat, and then there's also an expansion of animal feed market within the country. At the same time, Chinese domestic price for corn, in fact, are higher than international price. So that really means that in the end, these two factors together, right? Rising global price of corn, there's a big market demand in China, and then that became the natural outlet for Myanmar's maize because of geographical proximity and the long porous border. And then that was basically subsequent expansion of maize cultivation in northern parts of Xi'an State that was destined for the Chinese market. So empirically, we can look at the three regions of the Xi'an State in a way that the region that is closest to China are the ones experienced the most amount of deforestation during this past decade, during this decade, just two decades, in fact. And in some ways, basically the main driver for that deforestation, the expansion of commercial maize plantation in the region as a response to the market incentive that is going on. Commercial expansion of commercial agriculture, and it's not simply just in maize. In fact, before COVID time, actually, the commercial the expansion of commercial agriculture in Myanmar had much of its market targeted at China. At that time, almost 90% of Myanmar's watermelon was supposed to sell to China, and in addition to many other tropical foods, vegetables, etc. Right, so in the sense that basically as a result of the growing Chinese appetite for tropical products and also for proteins and other things, then many South Asian countries became the downstream countries to supply those products. And many of them actually do have environmental implications in the region. So to conclude, right, and the ripple effect that I'm trying to demonstrate in the book essentially is due to the multifaceted implications of China's presence in the region. And obviously, on the one hand, the state was present, right, in a sense that there are many cases where the state deliberately tried to influence Southeast Asian states and societies. But then again, on the other hand, many non-state actors from China were equally important in many sense to making their presence felt and then lead to subsequent implications. At the same time, when we think about inference, and obviously people tend to assume or oftentimes, conflate many of those things as the result of this intention by the Chinese state or not. But then empirically, that intentionality is actually very difficult to prove. And then many things happen in the region are in fact unintended consequences of this multi-faceted presence in the region. So with that said, right, finally, I just want to give you an outlook of the book, right? In addition to three things I mentioned, authoritarianism, trade, and then consumption, and I also looked at illicit political economy, particularly looking at scam centers and the rising casino economy, and also looked at the push for Chinese education in Southeast Asia and its contested nature in the region, and also I looked at diaspora and the migration encounters between Chinese migrants in Southeast Asia. So with that, I will stop, and then happy to answer any of your questions. Thank you.
Wonderful talk. Quick question first before we open up to the audience. Could you maybe speak a little bit more about the sort of the backgrounds of some of these non-state actors? So specifically in the Myanmar case, you were saying telling about the maize being sold across the Chinese border, with the supply and demand made sense to, but was that mostly by Chinese nationals coming into Myanmar wanting to solve the problem in China, or was that mostly Myanmar nationals wanting to sort of take advantage of the opportunity of a situation right across the border wanting to make money, or how did the non-state actors sort of get to that?
Right. So empirically, obviously, it's mixed, right? At both. But if you want to point out, on the one hand, there would have been quite a lot of Chinese businessmen who have gone to Southeast Asia as contract farmers, right? So in a way that they go to Southeast Asia to lease land from local communities, specifically for agricultural activity, right? So this has been the case, for example, in Laos. Many Chinese businesses go to Laos to do a banana plantation, right? And then those banana will be exported directly back to China, right? And similarly, in Myanmar's case, many of those commercial agriculture, they tend to be financed by Chinese business money, right? Because in general, this is an asymmetrical relation, right? You have more business in China have the resources than the ones in Myanmar. But on the other hand, it's not simply just the Chinese actors were involved. I mean, to do business in Southeast Asia, you require local collaborators or local partners, right, who have the ability to get land and other legal elements ready. So that means within Myanmar as well as within Laos or Thailand, etc., there's always this local partner that usually, well, in Thailand's cases, they call nominees, in a way that they basically provide all the legality for those business operations, and then usually it's through this kind of collaboration that's where those kind of economic activities were carried out.
Gotcha. Not that there's a huge sort of, in comparison to the United States, there's a very large sort of societal aspect in terms of third party players that aren't government related. Not that that necessarily is a huge aspect of the Chinese example of this, but does that exist, or is there a component to those types of actors that exist in some of these other countries that are also facilitating these lines of communication between China and Laos or Cambodia or Thailand, or is it all basically just private business? Is it private business and then government? Is those are the two sort of actors that you're looking at?
So in the commercial agricultural dimension is mostly private businesses, right? And then so there is actually quite good. Some scholars actually have done some work to compare the US relations with some Caribbean countries, in some like Banana Republic, for example, that kind of concept of sort of commercial dependence on the US market. And similarly, in the Chinese context as well, increasingly Chinese businesses are going to Southeast Asia to integrate Southeast Asia supply chain into its own domestic market within the country. Right. So in a sense that previously, for example, in Thailand's case, Thailand export a very high percentage of its durian to Chinese market, which is very profitable. So previously it was mostly Thai companies, Thai farmers, and then go through Chinese middlemen and then sell to Chinese market, right? But increasingly now is the Chinese businessmen to replace the Thai farmer, Thai businesses, and then to try to integrate their own market by itself. Okay. So that has basically is a phenomenon that is happening at this moment.
Gotcha. And just to clarify, the rationale for the book in general is that most people who study this space were only looking at the top-down factors and not...
Right. So scholars, for example, look at China's relation to Southeast Asia tend to be very exclusively focused on the Chinese state.
Right.
And they usually tend to be very security-oriented. Right. So that's why many accounts tend to look at China's presence with relation with the Philippines in terms of territorial disputes, in terms of in the Mekong region, in terms of how Chinese state is trying to avoid responsibility for the Mekong River, river resource management, etc. But then that has been the general account that tend to be very state focused. So my effort is that obviously I don't want to repeat what people have already said, right? So in a sense that this is basically an effort to provide an alternative account of many other things happening, but then has not really been taken seriously.
Right. I get that. Questions?
Yes.
Thank you so much. I learned a lot. I study a lot of decision-making processes of democratic allies in Asia, of the United States. So this is interesting because, as you know, a lot of Southeast Asian countries are still authoritarian or not consolidated democracies. Mm-hmm. So I guess I wanted to ask you more about what your view is about how these, non-democratic or more authoritarian countries make decisions at the state level when you see all these non-state actor level connections happening between China and within their own population. So, and this question kind of comes up when I was listening to your description about Thailand, because you were saying the conservative or sort of military regime wanted to use the China card to legitimize themselves. But I wanted to ask you from whom, right? So who are they sort of trying to legitimize their control? Is it really about the public opinion? Is it about the elite level political dynamics?
Right.
So I understand all these ripple effects does happen, but I still wanted to hear your views about how these authoritarian governments make decisions on policy at the top level when they have considered these interest groups within their states being influenced by China. Is there a disconnect between the state level decision making and interest groups being propped up by Chinese influence? Or is it basically the same compared to the democratic governments in Asia?
Right. I would say it's one aspect, and I think I've been thinking about as well, right, in terms of why Chinese influence in Southeast Asia is stronger in some countries than others, right? And I think this is basically the aspect of receptivity, in a way that in some countries, Chinese influence are much more easily being received, or in some countries, Chinese influence are much easier to penetrate than in other countries, right? So which means that lots of times we have to take seriously the agency of recipient states, right? So in a sense that, as I have argued elsewhere, the Chinese state cannot really force countries to do things they otherwise they would not do, right? So which means you need a willing counterpart to make things work. Right. So we think about Southeast Asia overall, in some countries like Philippines or Vietnam, right, Chinese influence probably is very minimal, right? Because, you know, there is very strong and, you know, antipathy, right, towards China, that it's difficult to see how China will be able to influence the domestic political process within the Philippines, for example, or in Vietnam. But in other countries, such as Thailand or you know, in Myanmar, you have one at least domestic players that want China to be involved in some aspect, right? So Myanmar case is easier in a way that the military is asking for Chinese support. But even in Thailand's case, we have seen is the, you know, on the one hand is a conservative element, right? On the other hand, is also the business collusion, right? You can say, but then again, they all go together, right? Big business is also the ones who are supporting the conservative element in the country. So in this particular case, then we see is the kind of you know, the old collusion of money in politics, and in Thailand's case, and I think this is also related with the overseas Chinese dimension. I didn't talk so much so far on that question, but essentially it is that, right? In a way that most, in Thailand's case, the biggest businesses tend to be Sino-Thai, right? And then these big conglomerates, right? They are the ones, on the one hand, politically, economically most influential in the country, but they're also the ones that have very intimate relations with China, right? You know, one of the best examples would be, CP, right, which is the largest agricultural conglomerate in Thailand. But then they have very intimate investment within China and have many other business collaborations, and also, in fact, have intimate relations with the Communist Party, the family, you know. So that is kind of the story, in a way that, even the current prime minister, right, his family is also very intimately involved with the large business sectors with China, in real estate sector, right? So then you can see this easy collusion relationship working out in a way that the maintenance of a political relation with China is, in that sense, beneficial to the ruling elites within the country. And that's why you have the situations where the continuation of authoritarianism is, in that sense, is they go side by side with the presence of China.
Let me do a question online real quick, and then we'll go to Stephanie. This is from Hong Zhang, who is also another CWP fellow.
Yeah, not on the, he's not on.
That's on.
It's on, okay.
Yeah. This is from Hong Zhang once again. She says, thank you so much, Enzer, for the fascinating book and presentation. Once again, there was a question about what the book was titled, so I put this slide back up for all those online. I really like the title Ripple Effect, which captures the sense of not only the far-reaching chain reactions, but also the lack of control by the central actor or state over its impacts in the spirit of trying to disentangle the state's intended goals versus unintended consequences. Could you provide an analysis of such a counterfactual? If the Chinese state did not push for an agenda, for example, for the Belt and Road Initiative, how different or not would China's engagement in Southeast Asia look like nowadays?
Okay. Thank you, Stella, for the question. I think it's actually quite interesting when we look at the Belt and Road Initiative, right? So this, at least at the economic dimension, means that quite a lot of substantial amount of investment going to Southeast Asia. Now, Belt and Road Initiative in some ways is a very complicated one. People tend to conflate with all kind of Chinese investment as Belt and Road Initiative, right? But in reality, the BRI is very specifically infrastructure oriented, right? And most of them should be state-owned enterprises. Because if you want to invest in Southeast Asia as part of BRI, like majority of them is basically Chinese state capital and going to specific sectors of like, you know, building roads, railway, mining, hydropower dam, etc. Those kind of things. But in reality, you see all kind of businesses, right? People open up a hotel. They say, this is part of Belt and Road. You know, open up a casino. See, this is Belt and Road. So you have that kind of process where empirically many private businesses, they try to latch onto this grand strategy to provide legitimacy for themselves in the eyes of the public, in the sense that, you know, they try to pretend I know all the big bosses in China. I'm part of BRI. That's why this project is important. You know, you better buy my products. So I think that process usually is the side effect, in a way that it was definitely not coordinated by Beijing, but then somehow happened throughout Southeast Asia. So one of the good examples of that was at one point, there was a expansion of casinos in Cambodia, right? And many of them basically claim they are part of BRI. They are basically talking about how the growth of Sihanoukville is basically China's sort of grand strategy to make Sihanoukville the new Shenzhen of Cambodia. But in reality, all what they're doing was open up online casinos and then, you know, open up hotels but then those things were meant, and in the end, later on, they had very high rate of crime as a result of those kind of CD activity they're doing, right? So that's why in the end, Beijing had to come out to clarify that we are not related with them. You know, these are basically not part of BRI. And the Cambodian, the Chinese embassy in Cambodia, as well Chinese embassy in Myanmar, a few times have to come out to clarify they were not associated with any of those businessmen, you know? So that is kind of interesting phenomenon to think about.
Great. Thanks so much. I thought this discussion around the authoritarian resilience was super interesting and the different pathways through which maybe China is intentionally or unintentionally propping up authoritarian regimes. And it seemed that Thailand was the case where it was definitely unintended in a way. You know, obviously, they're using narratives that aren't necessarily pro-China. And it reminded me of how the United States would also rhetorically support democracy abroad, but in reality would be fine with autocracies if they're kind of aligned with their interests. Mm. So I'm curious, do you think China faces some kind of trade-off in that sense as well? Like in Thailand, maybe an autocracy is continued, you know, that regime continues, but at the expense of, or not at the expense necessarily, but they're leaning maybe against China. Like, is there a trade-off there, or is this comparison really not?
I think actually it makes sense. I mean, you know, in many instances, in particular, in the Thai case, actually I wrote a paper elsewhere, I was actually talking about exactly the same phenomenon in a way that by explicitly associating itself with the military government, sometimes come at expense of China's public image within Thai society, right? So the comparison would be that previously China actually had a very good relationship with the previous democratic elected government And then in fact, that didn't really hinder China's, you know, interest in the country anyway. So same with Myanmar as well, you know. On the one hand, by associating yourself closely or basically by being presented as the benefactor of the military, come at the expense of popular resistance toward China within Myanmar, right? So I think that is the reason why right now, for example, the animosity towards China in Myanmar is extremely high. And similarly in Thailand as well, the younger generation, the pro-democracy people tend to have very negative opinions of China because of the military tend to associate itself as a result of like China's being the one who providing support for the military.
Yeah, I was just curious. I had read a couple of months ago that China was actually helping the rebels in Myanmar because they claimed that they had kidnapped Chinese to work in the call centers there. Does that sort of tie in with what you were saying about the Belt and Road or
right.
Influence?
Right.
Is that in the Shan state that was going on?
In two places. So most of the first of all, Myanmar is very fragmented, right? So there are quite a lot of Myanmar's peripheral regions are not really under centralized control. They're basically inhabited by a variety of ethnic armed groups, right? Empirically, the strongest presence of scam industry is along the Thai border with the Karen state. And that's where, you know, actually I talked about in the book is a place called Myawadi. And so Shui Kho Kho, that's the region, has, arguably at one point, they say more than 100,000 of people working there for scam centers, you know. But the one you're referring to are the ones in Northern Shan state. They tend to be less prominent historically, but recently there was a big military operation right in the region. So this is the situation where at the time there were three rebels who tried to retake the area that belonged to them, right? It's a extremely messy situation. On the surface, they claim they are doing this job on behalf of China's government in a way that they are cleaning out these scam industries and to free those hostages who are working in those scam centers. Okay. So what has happened afterwards was basically a deliberate intervention by China in Myanmar domestic politics, right? By supporting those rebels. And also try to broker a ceasefire agreement between them and then the military. So this is basically a very complicated case, obviously. But then again, in Southeast Asia, throughout Southeast Asia, I will argue that Myanmar probably is the case where China does breach its non-intervention principle in other country domestic politics quite a few times. And then that's because, first of all, the country is fragmented. That you have to deal with many actors, otherwise it's not going to work, right? So that's why China has maintained close relations with, on the one hand, with military, but on the other hand, also with many other, you know, rebel groups who has the genuine control of a particular region.
Thanks for this amazing talk. So my question is surrounded by how much the local community is receptive to the Chinese influence. So I wonder, when the businessman is making a decision where to allocate their money, do they consider how much of the diaspora engagement or the community engagement they already have in like different countries, and then they consider their money will go there? Or does this like new, like more ambitious investment projects can actually shape, like break the past continuity in those countries and kind of shape people's perceptions to kind of this like new era of investment?
Right. So I think in Southeast Asia, one of the distinct factor, and I think I mentioned earlier in the way that it is a very sizable overseas Chinese community in the region. And then, it has being a common feature of Chinese investment in the region to go with the area they have a guanxi network. And usually those are a local Chinese businesses in the country who have been living in this country for 100 years, but then they still maintain some kind of an unofficial relation with China through, hometown associations from a variety of Bureau of Commerce, and et cetera, right? So this has been, so in that sense, there is this kind of reconnection with the home motherland, in that sense, homeland, in a sense, in terms of those existing local Chinese businesses, and then now they realize that is actually opportunities to be made by inviting Chinese investment to those countries, and then they can benefit from such collaboration, right? So that, for example, that means in some ways has strengthened some of those sort of overseas Chinese presence within Southeast Asia. Yeah, so that means it has strengthened this very dominant economic position by the overseas Chinese. And I think Chinese investment to Southeast Asia further strengthened that.
The presentation, I wonder if at some point you address, first of all, the sharp slowing down of BRI funding. Mm. Because I know the process of publishing a book takes so long.
Right. Yeah.
And I don't know how much updating is possible, because a lot of that changed in the past few years, right. Like up and down,
yes,
because of COVID. And right. Then the second thing was whether you got to talk to Chinese officials and sort of the sort of puzzling that they have done over some of these phenomena. So like a quick background is like when I was doing research in Cambodia, and of course my father at the time was ambassador, we had talks with the Chinese embassy. Obviously we had some strategic competition over the region, but to some senses we also had shared goals of limiting like illegal drug trade, human trafficking and things like that. And and to some extent they were also sort of trying to, they had the responsibility to protect the citizens, but they also had the responsibility to sort of shut down some of these gangs that have fled there, right? And Xi Jinping's also sort of put that responsibility on the embassy to do that, because a lot of money is flowing out of China, right? So I just wonder if you've gotten talked about that side of the story a bit
Okay, so on the first element, I think during COVID, definitely, I think COVID, I mean, obviously, like COVID, I would say, has a very dramatic effect on economic relations between China and Southeast Asia, right? And so many of those, like, for example, the commercial agricultural dimension, and then at least in the first 2 years, shut down, right? The borders closed, nothing can go in and then go out, right? So that means at that time, lots of those kind of vegetable farms in Myanmar who were supposed to sell those, fruits and et cetera to China, they were rotten in the field because nobody can buy them, right? And then, so I think, and then obviously the coinciding with the slowdown of Chinese economy, right? And then also the BRI. So I think, I'm not an expert on BRI in general. And I think the people have, from what I heard, from what I understand, and there is a recalibrating of the BRI in general, right? So in a way that it probably be less wasteful than before, and then it probably be more targeted in other ways. Now, in that sense, and I think there are certain aspects of Chinese investment in Southeast Asia are going to be rebranded as part of that. And some people have called it like greening BRI or something, right? That is the substantial amount of Chinese investment in renewable energy in Southeast Asia, particularly in terms of the, like in Indonesia's case, right, investment in battery factories, and also in terms of the electronic vehicle sectors. So for that, you can see that, lots of the money now are going to Indonesia and Thailand. And Thailand, for example, being the largest automaker in Southeast Asia, right? So Thailand's interesting. Thailand does not have its national brand. Right? It's not like Malaysia. Malaysia has its own, brand. But Thailand does not have its national sort of brand. But Thailand is the processing, kind of assembly center, right? Previously, was many Japanese companies' cars go to South Thailand and assemble Toyota, etc. For the regional distribution. So what China is doing right now is that on the one hand they're building more, but they're also doing acquisitions of some of previously Japanese assembly lines for their own purposes. Yeah, so that has been a phenomenon that people have been paying attention to, in a sense that quite a lot of Chinese sort of, let's say, EV companies have gone to Thailand for that purpose. Yeah. Now, for your second question, I did not really have that kind of access, you know, to those officials as much. But in reality, you do feel the difficulties that, to be honest, the lack of capacity for the Chinese embassy in Cambodia, to be honest, right? At one point, you have like a million or so people living in Cambodia. The embassy is very small, right? How could they do consular service when you have people try to call them saying, that, oh, I got kidnapped, you come to rescue me? It's basically out of the capacity of the embassy, right? So that's basically has been the case in a way that I think, in many instances, the Chinese state, its capacity on the ground is very, very limited in terms of either protecting the citizens or doing other things. It's very limited in the very, you know, official capacity, but then in many other aspects of like commerce or consular service, etc., they were totally outstaffed.
So another question online, how does your discussion thus far sort of relate to other countries in Southeast Asia, specifically sort of Singapore and Malaysia? And I guess more importantly, is that potentially the groundwork for another book is the question.
So I think Singapore, actually, I did actually wrote about Singapore. I'm not too familiar with Malaysia, that's why. But I did talk about Singapore in the book. Singapore is actually very interesting, you know, in a sense that, on the one hand, geopolitical competition between US and China has benefited Singapore tremendously, right? In a sense that, Singapore has become the headquarter for quite a lot of big Chinese companies going abroad. Right. So the case of obviously like ByteDance, right? The mother company is ByteDance, and then you have TikTok, and then it's Douyin. Douyin is domestic market, and TikTok is international market, right? So TikTok is headquartered in Singapore. And similarly, quite a few other like Alibaba, so basically acquired Lazada, and also like Tencent has quite a substantial amount of capital investment in Shopee, which are the largest e-commerce, platforms in Southeast Asia, and they all headquartered in Singapore, right? So that means Singapore, in some ways, is helping China internationalize, right? Basically, Chinese money, Chinese companies or Chinese money now is basically becoming, at least technically, legally, it is Singaporean money. A Singaporean company is doing those kind of investment, right? So that's why if you look at Chinese investment to Southeast Asia, the largest country of recipient is always Singapore. But then later on, the money will go to somewhere else, right? Singapore is the place where you bank the money and then go abroad. So now, the negative consequence for Singapore in this case is that because so much hard money are going to Singapore, and it's actually, it's not necessarily, it's not simply just because of the Western money going to Singapore, right? Lots of Chinese money went to Singapore in the past few years. So one of the negative consequences of that is the real estate sector basically became overheated, right? So many Chinese like wealthy people, right, go to Southeast Singapore to buy property. And then that's why during COVID time, like, obviously 2020, 2021, 2022, Singaporeans, the real estate, within a year, appreciated like 50%, So that is substantial amount of, overheating of the real estate sector. And then, and that has, basically later on led to the government to implement a very draconian measure on stamp duties. Basically foreign buyers now have to pay 60% of stamp duty on their purchase. So that's kind of the interesting kind of a dimension of the Singapore actually. On the one hand, obviously big beneficiary, but then again, on the other hand, there are also negative kind of dimensions of that, more close economic relation with China.
Right. And I do get that your book focuses on these perhaps slightly less studies, because, you know, obviously because there is so much money going to Singapore, the interest in what's happening in Singapore is a lot written about it in general. But would you be interested in dipping your toe more into potentially having a further book on that subject, or is it mostly so just...
I'm interested in some, not necessarily in Singapore, but Singapore probably part of it. I'm very interested in the diaspora dimension, right? And in the book, actually, I did talk about this sort of diaspora engagement between China and Southeast Asia. And also, you know, if you want to talk about diaspora, then you cannot talk without Singapore, right? In a way that Singapore is the biggest, you know, overseas Chinese society in that sense. So one element that is actually quite interesting for the past decade is the acquisition by mainland Chinese capital of Southeast Asia-based Chinese language media. So this is basically the traditional, like, you know, Chaobao, right? It's overseas Chinese land newspapers, etc. And then increasingly they are now being acquired by mainland Chinese capital. So that means in Southeast Asia, then you have those newspapers published, printed, you know, in Chinese, being circulating around, and then they will probably have a different tone in their descriptions of global affairs or China-related activities versus the Anglicized kind of, you know, newspapers within the region, right? So that, I think, is a very interesting dimension. I think. So that's obviously, I talked about in the book a little bit on that aspect. So further future study, for example, in my opinion, and I will be, you know, I'm interested in this diaspora dimension. I think this, you know, diaspora relations with China is extremely complicated, right? People previously escaped China because of famine, war, and everything, right? Went to Southeast Asia. But then again, these days, the homeland has also changed in a variety of ways, right? So how people either reconnect or reject those kind of integrated relations with China has quite a lot of variations in Southeast Asia. So on the one hand, in some countries, there is a phenomenon these days called re-Sinicization, is that people previously were deprived the opportunity to become Chinese. And nowadays they are now reconnecting with China. So that's the situation in Indonesia, that previously, for example, many Indonesian Chinese have to, you know, change their name to Indonesian names, and then they never had, they would not have access to Chinese education. And then these days they start to retake that ancestral Chinese name, or they'll start to learn Mandarin, etc. So that phenomenon has been happening in Indonesia, and also to a great extent in Thailand as well.
Yeah. One more question online, and then I'll throw it back out to the audience. And I don't know how much this, you know, is it part of your research, but I'm going to ask it anyway. The person is curious about the broader impact of high-speed rail on Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. They've recently attended a session with the Chinese Academy of Railway Sciences, mm-hmm. and they learned that Chinese ambitions extend beyond the Belt and Road construction to the execution of the Indonesian Maritime Fulcrum Initiative. Have you come across this? And particularly, they're interested in learning more about, as you just mentioned, Indonesia's influence in the shifting power dynamics between Asia and Australia, as well as its role relative to other Southeast Asian nations.
Mm. So in Indonesia's case, I mean, I also do not know too much about Indonesia, but at least there is this, September last year, the Jakarta-Bandung Railway, right, completed. So from what I heard, apparently was also widely reported in the news, that most of the Indonesians are actually quite proud of the project, in a way that has been placed and then has operating well, right? So how further those railway investment, what kind of implication would that be? I actually would think Indonesia and also the mainland countries actually quite different, right? I mean, think about it, right? Railway in Indonesia cannot go anywhere, if you're in Java, you're in Java, right? You cannot connect the railway easily across the ocean to Sulawesi or other islands, right? But in the mainland, they can be connected, right? I mean, the goal for the Pan-Asian Railway, you know, originally was to connect Kunming with Singapore, right? Which is possible, right? So that means, you know, like the East Rail Link right now is under construction in Malaysia, connecting, you know, Guangdong with KL. And they say they're going to complete by 2027. KL and Singapore is not too far already, right? So then you can think about that implication in the sense that perhaps in the long, in a not too distant future, there might be a integrated transnational kind of railway system in mainland parts of Southeast Asia. So that will have, on the one hand, obviously economic kind of implication, but also strategic implications, right? But then again, currently, at least the design of the railway in terms of its strategic implication, I would say can be, depending on how you look at it, you know, I would say it's still very confined because so the railway so far, and the one between China and Laos is standard grid.
Gauge.
But not in Thailand. So Thai railway is narrow gauge. So that means the railway, so right now what's happening is that there is a construction of a sort of kind of a station in south part of Yanjiang. So where in the future, the railway will the train will stop in that, and it will have to change its gauge, and then will go to Thailand, right? So that in some way defeats the purpose of, let's say, I don't know, military purpose, you know, use of the railway. Yeah. So I think that for me is very interesting in the sense that you know, there is this kind of a you know gauge difference. Thailand is narrow gauge, and then Laos is standard.
Actually, my question was very related to this because I knew about, so I was watching some of the competition in Indonesia about between Chinese high rail and Japan high, and then Japan lost the high rail, but they won the metro system.
Right.
So Indonesia was sort of balancing between the two competitors. And I've also heard that the Indonesian government, or at least maybe the decision makers, weren't quite happy about the delay of the construction of the high-speed rail by the Chinese government because they initially wanted that to be done before the election so that the leadership can win sort of the credibility or the sort of celebrate it before the election. But so the question I was thinking was how much sort of when these countries in Southeast Asia think about the risks of Chinese influence and think about alternative competitors and how to balance those effects, how much do they think about what other countries in the Southeast Asia are doing? Like, is there intra-regional competition or sort of, you know, because these countries are competing against each other of who's going to be the better partner for a particular country or not? Like, is that competition helping China to enhance its influence or... because of what you mentioned about sort of rail being potentially connected within the continental Asia, and that may also enhance China's potential military use of railway. What's happening in other countries in the Southeast Asian, ASEAN countries, is it also impacting particular countries' decision over whether to accept China's rail or, you know, investment in particular sector?
Yeah. So I think the interesting thing so far is not so much of Southeast Asian countries competing against each other for Chinese investment. Rather, what happens more actually is a particular country in Southeast Asia make use of China versus Japan as a way to play one against each other in their investment particularly in key infrastructure, right? So this was the case in Indonesia, where you mentioned basically China got one and Japan got the other one, but also in Thailand as well, right? I mean, Thailand at one point was, they have two high-speed rail line, right? So one is connecting to the Laos border, and the other one is connecting to Chiang Mai, right? So then that has been very successful in terms of on the government part point of view to negotiate with China to lower its interest rate. And then in the end, the Thai project was not financed by China, was financed by Thailand itself, right? And vice versa, Thailand can bargain with Japanese. You have to give me a very, very good deal. Otherwise, your project isn't, I would basically go to China, right? So that's kind of the question in the sense that it actually has a negative consequence because particularly with Japan line, with the one connecting back with Bangkok, Chiang Mai, right? At that time, Thailand bargained very successfully and Japan agreed onto the deal. And in the end, Japan realized that the deal is not profitable. So in the end, Japan canceled it. So that's why so far the Chiang Mai and Bangkok railway is not going to happen because Japanese government's final feasibility project was not feasible. So
there's a question, Jingzhi from Princeton University, ironically enough. And they were wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the differential strengths and weaknesses of Chinese state actors and non-state actors in the Southeast Asian region in general. Specifically, how do the local public view these Chinese actors, and can they differentiate which ones are state and which ones are non-state actors? What might be some factors that determine whether they support or oppose these activities?
I think for ordinary people, I think people will not be able to differentiate, right? Whether it is state or non-state. But in general, I would say public opinion in China, in Southeast Asia toward China, Chinese presence in the region, are not very positive, right? But then there are multiple reasons why that's the case, right? If you look at some of those, well, first of all, there's not really very good public opinion data on Southeast Asia. I mean, even the ones still Southeast Asia that published by ICEAS in Singapore is not public opinion. It's basically political elites' opinion. So that doesn't mean they don't necessarily reflect public opinion, right? But overall, you can see clearly, you know, countries such as Vietnam and Philippines tend to have more anti-Chinese sentiment than other ones. But overall, I would say in Southeast Asia, people do not necessarily, at least from a public point of view, do not necessarily like China or Chinese actors in the region, right? But on the other hand, I also do think people's views of Chinese actors are more complicated in a sense that, Chinese presence in Southeast Asia is very long. So which means that the presence of Chinese in a particular country usually are often, understood as the familiar other. That's usually kind of the phrase I use, is that these are the people we know for a very long period of time. And that's why they're coming. They're very different from us in many ways. They are oftentimes associated with certain good, certain bad traits with that behavior, but then sometimes they tolerate that. So I think that would be my judgment in a way that it's neither a resistance nor a proactive kind of, you know, affinity, rather than is kind of some kind of tolerance with certain reservation. That'd be my take.
Is there also an aspect of that that's just indifference?
I don't think necessarily it's indifference, because the relationship can be very intimate, right? There's lots of, let's say, business relations and then other things. So I would not say it's indifference. People know what's happening, right? For example, in Thailand, you can see the implications of so many Chinese tourists and migrants coming to the country, and then and people know, you know, that presence is there, the best restaurants opening and other things happening, you know, the food is happening, it's food styles are also changing, right? So they understand that. Yeah.
Gotcha. Other questions?
So I find the discussion about how those Southeast Asian countries actually have a larger bargaining power than we expected is very fascinating. Mm. So do you So since like the EV is also like an emerging trend and mm-hmm. a lot of things have changed in these regions, do you think that you would expect to see other types of competition between China versus other market like Japan or the US, where Southeast Asians can play a bigger role in deciding where which partner they want to choose?
So I think so in the electronic vehicle sector, I think it's quite different from high-speed rail. High-speed rail is very exclusively state, right? It's basically Chinese Railway Corporation. But it's very much, you know, state-owned enterprises, and usually the Chinese state bargain on its behalf. But electronic vehicles is not. They are usually done by many, you know, private companies, some formerly state-owned enterprises, but then these days have become very much commercialized. So they sometimes might even compete with against each other, right, in their investment in a particular project in Southeast Asia. But still, I don't know too much. It's still very much a very new phenomenon that is happening. So I think different governments have different strategies. So like Malaysia, for example, Malaysia does have a champion domestic automaker. So that means Malaysia's strategy might be encouraging collaboration between, you know, Malaysian, I forgot the name, anybody can help me, start with a P. That's the Malaysian automaker's name. So which means that basically Malaysia is trying to encourage like collaboration, like basically joint ventures, et cetera, between the Malaysian, what's it called? Patron something? Patrona?
Proton.
And then like that. But in Thailand, like I said, Thailand doesn't have a natural champion automaker. So that means it's more of different assembly companies. Now they are being forming different kind of a collaboration with Chinese companies, right? So that means I guess automaker, you have different supply chains, right? Some make this, some make that, you know, et cetera, right? So basically it's a Chinese company coming in, try to make use of existing supply chains, or some probably build some more, but then essentially is more of a collaborative relation in that regard, right? So that, in a sense, because some of the actors involved, I don't think it will be very much monopolized.
So we're actually going to end a couple minutes early. Mm. We're almost at time. We're going to end a couple minutes early for two reasons. One, Enzo needs to get to his next talk at Princeton in a couple hours. So maybe Jingzhe, who asked the question online, can show up and ask it in person. And the other thing is we have a couple of his books, The Ripple Effect. So we're going to do a quick sort of book signing and sales. But other than that, let's give our speaker a warm round of applause. Thanks, everyone, for joining us online. I'm going to end the session now.
All right. Thank you.